Bishop Athanasius of Alexandria. He's figured pretty prominently in recent episodes because of his role in standing against the Arian heresy that had proved such a problem for the church of the 4th century. Now, when we first met Athanasius, I mentioned the religious hermits that he visited as a young man. They lived in the wilderness near his home in Alexandria. As did many others, he took food and basic supplies to them. Athanasius greatly respected these men who forsook the ease of city life to pursue undistracted devotion to God. But just who were these hermits, and what moved them to such a radical departure from the lifestyle that had been modeled by Jesus and the apostles? While the theology of monks and monasteries evolved over many generations, its earliest expression drew from the example of John the Baptist, forerunner of Christ who was something of an ascetic. Now, John's haunt was the Judean wilderness where it intersected the Jordan River. He wore a less-than-fashion-conscious wardrobe and ate a strict organic diet grudgingly provided by the wilderness. It's no coincidence that the earliest Christian hermits appeared in the same region where Gnosticism flourished. That's Egypt and Syria. You see, the hermits were influenced in part by Gnosticism's insistence that the physical realm was inherently evil. This fueled a desire for a detachment from worldly comforts. Though Christian hermits justified their removal from the city to the wilderness by Jesus' counsel to the rich young ruler to sell all his possessions, give the proceeds to the poor, and follow him. They emphasized the idea that the flesh and the spirit are at odds with each other. Assuming there was no reconciling them, hermits renounced the world by leaving a comfortable life in the city in favor of the absolute bare necessities of whatever living space they could carve out of the Egyptian desert and the Syrian wilderness. This lifestyle of deprivation and discomfort was regarded as the truest route to unhindered communion with God by hermits and their admirers. The first time we see a written expression of this emerging mindset is in the Shepherd of Hermas about AD 140. This early Christian document defines a higher and a lower route that believers can take in their devotion to God. Faith, hope, and love are the lower route required of all Christians. But for those that aspire to closer intimacy with God, self-denial was required. This self-denial took many forms, with celibacy being one of the more radical, yet one of the more popular methods. The practice of penance became common, with believers moved to dramatic acts of charity and bravery in order to prove their devotion to God. When persecution was a threat, of course, Christians used penance as a way to compensate for moments of weakness and fear. And of course, martyrs were luminous heroes that even some pagans admired. But with the repeal of persecution, the church needed new heroes and found them in hermits who engaged in extreme acts of self-denial. The word hermit comes from the Greek word for desert, pointing to where the hermits got their start. In Egypt, where the desert is plentiful outside the fertile strip of land along the Nile River. It was relatively easy for a would-be hermit to walk just a short distance from a city or village to the desert. That set them close to civilization and access to supplies. If the novice hermit decided that the ascetic life was too much, hey, it was just a quick and easy hike back to town. Now, things were a little different in Syria, where the transition zone between habitable land and the wilderness was much larger. Hermits in Syria tended to be a bit more serious and hardcore in their asceticism. And that sparked something of a rivalry between the hermits of the two regions, with news taken back and forth about what extremes this or that hermit was engaging in as they tried to outdo each other in displays of severity. All for God's glory, of course. Getting a little bit ahead of myself here. About 250 near Alexandria in Egypt, a 20-year-old named Anthony took Jesus' command to the rich young ruler to sell his possessions and follow him literally. Anthony sold everything and went to live in an abandoned tomb. Legends quickly grew up about his battles with temptation that took visible form in attacks by demons, wild beasts, and the most heinous of all, a seductive woman. Anthony emerged from each battle with a greater sense of devotion to God that inspired others to follow his example. And soon, dozens made their way to the wilderness to pursue a life of rigid self-denial. Anthony was the young Athanasius's favorite. And since Anthony lived to be over 100, he was alive when the future Bishop of Alexandria was taking supplies out to the hermits. Athanasius wrote a biography of Anthony, which became wildly popular. This book, more than any other influence, helped boost the esteem and appeal of hermits. Athanasius's portrait of Anthony served two purposes. First, it made Anthony an enthusiastic supporter of Athanasius in his battle with the Arians. And second, Athanasius aimed to score points for Egypt in what he called the noble contest with Syria over who had the best saints. Now, the book tells the tale of Anthony's 20 years as a hermit and all of the spiritual battles that he faced. As his fame spread, he was faced with a new problem. Huge crowds came out to witness a living saint. Egyptian hermits of the 4th century were famous for their self-denial. They began to compete with each other for bragging rights over whose asceticism was most intense. They set records for who could stand the longest. They left off eating all cooked foods. And not to be outdone by the extremes of their Egyptian counterparts, Syrian hermits engaged in terrifying feats of endurance and punishment. Now, they squeezed into tiny spaces, they crawled into caves and sealed up the entrance, except for just a small hole through which bread and water passed from the never-ending line of supplicants, asking for special prayer or blessing. Some hermits' claim to fame was to resign themselves to wallow in their own filth. The Latin Church Father Jerome, who would later produce the Bible known as the Latin Vulgate, immigrated to Palestine, interested in trying the lifestyle of a hermit. The adventure didn't last long. He quickly realized that he was not cut out for the intense self-denial of those Syrian hermits. Now, part and parcel of the hermetic life was an isolated individualism that stands in contrast to the communal life that had been modeled by Jesus and the apostles and urged in the New Testament. You don't have much of a body of Christ when it's just one guy in a cave. Hermits found refuge in the wilderness, an easy way to avoid the temptations of the external world. But what about the far more dangerous inner temptations of the soul? Things like pride and envy. Now, their temptation to pride is obvious. After all, it was easy for the desert ascetics who'd taken the supposed higher pathway to consider themselves better than others. But how could envy be a problem when they lived alone? Well, sure, they lived alone, but they had plenty of visitors. Pilgrims made their way out to meet them and catch a few moments with those that they regarded as, well, living saints. As these pilgrims made the rounds of several hermits, they would report to each hermit the extreme acts of penance and piety of the others. Not wanting to be outdone in a show of devotion, hermits endeavored to surpass one another. They went on extreme fasts, they ate bizarre foods, they lived in trees on tops of pillars, and refused to bathe. As their acts became more bizarre, their fame grew, and soon thousands were flocking to see them. One hermit named Simeon, he was so put out by the crowds who came to see him that he climbed a 10-foot-tall pillar in some nearby ruins, determined to remain there until the people left him alone. But that only made him more interesting, and so the crowds swelled. So Simeon ascended another pillar, this one almost 60 feet high. There he erected a little wicker basket about the size of the carriage of a hot air balloon. And he spent the next 30 years there. Food was sent up to him via a rope and a basket. Now, the elders of a nearby town took it on themselves to evaluate the genuineness of Simeon's devotion to God. Was he really seeking God's glory or just his own by such extreme acts? So they decided to gather around the base of his pillar and demand that he come down. They reasoned that if he refused, they would take it as a sign of pride and forcibly remove him from his pillar. But if he consented to come down, they would regard it as evidence of humility and tell him, no, just stay there. So when they commanded him to come down, he promptly began his descent. And so they told him, yeah, never mind. While all this only added to Simeon's fame, he became known as Stylites, the pillar dweller. And soon there were dozens more hermits camping out on top of pillars. Simon Stylites became so sought after as an example of godliness that a church was built next to his pillar. And over the following centuries, the church grew around the pillar until it eventually was within it. And then pilgrims chipped away at it until its one-time height of 60 feet was reduced to only 10. While the popularity of hermits grew among commoners, some church leaders grew concerned about the message that was being sent about what it meant to, well, be the church. You see, in pursuing a life of isolation, even the most orthodox hermits seemed to deny the foundation on which the church was based, a spiritual community led by a bishop. Such a concern by church leaders seemed justified when, toward the end of the 4th century, a really weird sect emerged in Mesopotamia that was called the Messalians. They emphasized a self-directed pursuit of experiencing God that ended in some really bizarre practices. The movement was so obviously off, it was declared heretical and only a few years after it began, though much later, heresies were accused of retaining some of its beliefs. Church leaders worried that the hermits of Syria and Egypt would repeat the error of the Messalians in emphasizing the individual's spiritual experience over the community of faith. Their concerns were, number one, how could hermits partake of communion out in the desert? Number two, how did they relate to those who were now understood to be God's ordained church leaders, bishops? As with any extreme, it didn't take long before a calmer and more reasoned way challenged the decidedly non-biblical ultra-individualism of the desert hermits. So enter the monks and monasticism. About 320, someone remembered Genesis 2, verse 8. That people shouldn't be alone. Hey, maybe these hermits that we've made into living saints aren't really hitting the mark after all. So monasticism grew apace with the newfound imperial favor under Constantine and his successors. It's not difficult to understand why the number of ascetics jumped and monasticism became popular at the same time that the church and the state were buddying up. Being a Christian was no longer dangerous. So the sincerity of many new members declined. When people realized that belonging to a church was a social and political plus, well, the sincerity factor dipped even further. Genuine believers noted the sagging quality of faith among many of the church's fair-weather friends and responded by embracing a more rigorous path. The models of that era were the monks, those standout Christian heroes who'd attained an honor similar to that given the martyrs of the previous era. And hey, I don't have to have my head chopped off. Cool. Now, the monks of that time, they weren't so much fleeing the world as they were protesting a worldly church. There was an ex-soldier by the name of Pachomius who formed the first monastery. It was a place where Christians could pursue devotion to God in a communal setting. Instead of each monk deciding for himself how to live and what to do, drawing on his experience as a soldier, Pachomius set rules for the community. All members wore the same uniform, they engaged in similar labor, and kept the same schedule. While Pachomius' monastery was the first that we know of for men, women already had their own version of communal life. That had been necessary when women were not allowed to be hermits. Their isolation would have made them, a tempting target for criminals and brutes. Nonnus, that's the feminine form of the word monk, and so women who pursued the communal life were called nuns. Their cloistered communes were called convents. The monastic movement spread north out of Egypt into Syria, and then west into Asia Minor, which at that time was the most spiritually dynamic region of the faith. Once monasteries took root in Asia Minor, they spread rapidly across Europe. When Bishop Athanasius died in the spring of 373, three bishops from Cappadocia and Asia Minor picked up and continued to carry the standard of loyalty to the Nicene Creed: Basil the Great, Gregory of Nazianzus, and Gregory of Nyssa. These three greatly promoted the monastic movement. Basil was especially important as he authored the rule of discipline that framed monastic life for generations after, and does to this day in the Eastern Orthodox Church. Basil was also the first that we know of to establish the precedent for monks of becoming priests. Throughout the 4th and 5th centuries, monasticism gained popularity and infiltrated every level of society. The communal life of the monks reinfused the church with a sense of purpose and a return to the purity that had marked the church's earlier years. Martyrdom was replaced by a wholehearted devotion to God through renouncing a career of worldly success in favor of one lived in the imitation of Christ. In order to obtain this ideal within the context of communal life, monks took vows of obedience, poverty, and chastity. These were attempts to limit the battle line of temptation and sin by renouncing possessions, self-will, and the sexual urge. Monasteries helped put an end to the problems common to the earlier hermits: idleness and eccentricity. They became centers of social renewal and scholarship. By the 6th century, most church leaders either were or have been monks. Now, as touched on briefly a moment ago, one of the most notable monks from this period was Jerome, who lived from about 340 to 420. He began as a hermit in the Syrian wilderness. Despite best intentions, Jerome was plagued by sexual temptation. The only relief that he could find was when his mind was preoccupied by some overwhelming intellectual challenge. Someone suggested that he learn Hebrew, which for him proved to be an effective prescription against temptation. Once he'd mastered Hebrew, he traveled to Rome, where he became the tutor of a leading bishop and met a couple of brilliant women who, under his training, became as skilled as he in teaching the Bible. But when Jerome fell out of favor with some other monks at Rome, he moved to a monastery at Bethlehem, where he spent the next 22 years translating the Old and the New Testaments into Latin. At first, Jerome's translation was criticized because he used the street language of his day rather than the more refined classical Latin of antiquity. People considered his Bible vulgar, but it didn't take long before opinions changed and the Latin Vulgate was widely popular. The Roman Catholic Church used the Latin Vulgate as their official Bible until recent times. The man who had the most significant impact on monastic life was Benedict of Nursia, located not far from Rome. Benedict was educated in the capital, but when he was exposed to the extreme asceticism of the hermits, he cut short his schooling in favor of a solitary life in a cave 80 miles south. He spent 3 years studying the scriptures when local monks came for a visit. They were impressed with his learning and so asked if he would become their abbot, a monastery's leader. He agreed, but when the discipline that he required of them proved too rigorous, they tried to poison him, so he fled. Benedict took little more with him than a wisdom born of failure. Instead of chalking up his ouster from the monastery as a sign that he wasn't cut out to lead, he refined his ideas on how to conduct community life and began a new monastery at Monte Cassino, just south of Rome in 529. When Benedict died 13 years later, he left behind a pattern for monastic life that became the standard for hundreds of monasteries and helped safeguard European civilization during the intellectual declension of the Middle Ages, something that we'll return to in a later episode. It was at and for Monte Cassino that Benedict wrote his famous Rule. It was a brilliant merging of pragmatism and psychology. Benedict had learned how to administrate a commune of believers to enforce necessary discipline without being too harsh. He began by taking the basic monastic forms already in place and then installed a system of discipline that weeded out the lazy and the insincere. He knew the only way to accomplish the aims of a monastery was by maintaining authority and discipline, but the required obedience had to be such that an ordinary person could give. Benedict failed in his earlier attempt because he'd expected the monks to follow his own level of discipline, which he realized was greater than all but a few could emulate. Benedict's rule established the role of the monastery's abbot as sole authority to whom the monks owed unwavering and unquestioned obedience. But this authority couldn't be arbitrary, and so he made the selection of the abbot a choice for the monks themselves. His rule for the abbot was that any major decision must be made after consulting the monks for their guidance. He warned that going against their counsel was both unwise and unsafe. He cautioned abbots against an unchecked exercise of power. In a move that seems kind of prescient, Benedict advocated that each monastery would become a world unto itself. Work of both a manual and mental nature was seen as crucial to monastic life and central to devotion to God. And so each monastery became a self-supporting community, dependent on the outside world for little. What this meant was that as the Roman Empire disintegrated, the scholarship of the ancient world was preserved in the Benedictine monasteries where it was read, studied, and copied for generations. They became storehouses for the knowledge that would reemerge in the Reformation and the Renaissance, lifting Europe out of the Middle Ages. As we round out this episode, let's think about the extreme asceticism and self-denial of the hermits. It all sounds pretty crazy to us today, and yet hermits were considered by many people of their time to be luminous examples of godliness. It was the steady stream of supporters to their haunts in the wilderness that kept them alive, with offerings of food and drink, which the hermits partook of in utmost moderation, just enough to keep them alive to add to their mortification of the flesh and their fame. But why did hermits do this? How had the faith deviated so far from the example that Jesus had set? Well, it was a slow process. It began with the infiltration of the world's ideas about the way things are. As we saw when we were reviewing the Gnostics, Greek philosophy had a profound impact on shaping people's worldview. That is how they understood reality. It was widely accepted in Greco-Roman society that reality was a dualism of spiritual and material. The physical, material realm was inherently and unalterably evil, while the realm of the spirit was inherently and equally unalterably good. Humans were both spirit and body. What was good about them was trapped in what was bad. The key to elevating the good was by depriving the bad, by punishing it. Now, that's a simplistic explanation for the emergence of the hermits, but it serves our purposes here. If being a Christian means following Jesus, where'd the hermits get the idea that meant withdrawing from the world to live in isolation and depriving the body of all forms of pleasure? Jesus certainly never taught nor modeled that. Yes, he began his ministry by spending 40 days and nights fasting in the wilderness, but not 41 days, not 50 days, not 60 days. And for the rest of his ministry, he lived among others, eating and drinking. When some asked him why his disciples ate and drank while John the Baptist's disciples fasted often, Jesus responded that it was because he was present with them. Yes, there would come a time after he was gone that his followers would fast. But a fast, by its very nature, is a set period of time. It's limited. It's not a perpetual lifestyle of deprivation. It doesn't intentionally aim at punishing the body, which is what many hermits were aiming for. Their error was in allowing unbiblical ideas to color their view of the faith and what devotion to God looks and sounds like. Instead of God's word and spirit renewing their minds, the world had shaped their ideas on what it meant to be godly. Jesus never told his disciples to live alone in the wilderness. Indeed, he modeled for them perfect godliness, and that was to make his way through the world without the world making its way through him. As we follow Jesus, it behooves us to make sure that we're doing so in a manner that's consistent with what he wants, not merely in a way that aligns with our culture, including the culture of our particular religious tradition. There's a lot of this going on right now as progressivism does a massive rewrite of theology. The personal theology of many progressives, it isn't drawn from who and what God says, but from values of a man-centered secularism. And that is about as opposite from the hermits as one can get. Self-fulfillment, self-realization, self as center and ground of truth forms the core of contemporary ethics. Human beings no longer exist for God's glory as historic Orthodox Christianity has contended for 2,000 years. Under the progressivism that arose just about 4 seconds ago, God exists for our glory to make our lives meaningful. And one of the most absurd displays of this that I saw recently was a video of a progressive preacher saying that God worships us. 1,700 years ago, the hermits were wrong in their assumption that genuine godliness was all about mortification of the flesh. Progressive, consumerist Christianity today is equally wrong.